Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, London! Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's drinking Ricky Gervais's beers, is Richard Herring! Hello! Yes, it's Ricky. Ricky Gervais has left his Heineken 0% in the fridge. He was on just... He goes on at 4 o'clock, because, you know, they have to put the less popular acts on at times. He couldn't get an evening slot here, not Ricky Gervais. So I've had one already. If I drink, this is my second one, could get drunk. 0.5%. Lovely to see you all again. Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to some people doing the Harlem Shake. What's interesting about this podcast is it's been going long enough that some of the things that happened during its run are now were cool and are now naff within the space of me doing this. 2014, the Harlem Shake was. And some of the people who jumped around in the bit where it goes mad said they call it Rallus. Would you remember the Harlem Shake? I'm not even sure it's called the Harlem Shake now. while I'm here... I will say that after this long, long tour of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast is over, which it will be soon, please God, I will be again on tour doing Can I Have My Ball Back? And I'm here at the Leicester Square Theatre on the 8th of May, and there are a few tickets left for that one. I'm also at the Bloomsbury on the 7th of June. There's loads of tickets left for that one. And I think there's going to be some more good dates put in at the Leicester Square Theatre. So, dude, this is just for you in the room, because this is going out too late for... Oh, maybe not, actually. Actually, no, it's going out quite soon. Come and see my tour, everyone, please. Thank you for that. Thanks, everyone who's come to the... I found it difficult on tour. I was in Dublin this week, and then I went to Cardiff, and then I went to Sheffield, and then I've come to London. It's a lot of travelling. I find it difficult being just away from the kids for, like, one night. It's a sort of...
feel like you're making a trade-off, you're missing a night of your kid's life in order to entertain new people. So I'm not sure how long I'm going to carry on doing it. This isn't very funny, is it? No, I'll tell you some. But I've just been missing the kid. You know, it sort of makes it. That's what during lockdown I thought maybe I won't tour again. But you know, it's sort of you miss a precious night of your child's life. You only get that once. So fucking enjoy this, you pricks. What I'm giving up to give just the joy of laughter to 17 people in Stockport. Anyway, my kids are amazing. We had a great time at the weekend. It was Mother's Day when we were recording this at the weekend. My daughter last night, I'd said to her, I told she said, oh, I wish it's Friday because I'm doing something. I said, don't wish your life away. And then she came downstairs saying, I'm thinking about death because of you, Daddy. And I said, I was just saying, just enjoy being young. It'll pass quickly enough. And she said, I've got a theory about what it is when you're born. And she said, when you're a baby, before you're born, you're in a big white room with all the babies, and all the babies look exactly the same. And they're in queues of 10 babies at a time waiting to be born. She said, I don't know where she's got this from. And she said, some of the babies are pushy, and that's when you get twins and triplets. Amazing. So I think another 10 years, she'll be... I'll just pass this on. If you've watched the puppet show, you've seen that she's much funnier than I am anyway. So the most exciting thing that's happened to me this weekend is my wife discovered that if you're a member of Equity, you can park in Q Parks in London for £7 for 9 hours. And it's generally I'm just happier than I've ever been in my life. I'm parked in Chinatown. £7. I used to pay £55 to park in that car park. £7. I think I've got middle-aged. I think I've become middle-aged. So good. Yes, look, I haven't got much to talk about because I'm doing these every day and not much is happening. And I do have to have some material for next week's show as well. How am I going to write that? I've got a whole week to write that. That'll be fun. Let's crack on because we have an absolutely amazing guest for you this week. He's probably best known for his appearance on Packet of Three, one of my favourite comedy shows. Of course, he was also in Series 7, Week 5 of House of Games, where he was beaten by Sam Queck. And that's the only two things he's ever done. Will you please welcome the amazing Lem Cissé, ladies and gentlemen? It's Lem Cissé. Amazing. Lem Cissé. It's going to be a ride. It's going to be a fun ride, Lem. I can tell it. It's going to be a fun ride.
Come on, more.
Good, Lem. Oh. It's mainly an audio medium, Lem, but don't worry. It's fine. It'll be okay. How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah.
Good,
thank you,
lovely
yeah.
to see you.
It's great to be here.
What do you remember? I mean, Packet of Three is one of my favourite shows to reference on this. Yes. It obviously starred Jenny Clare,
Henry Normal,
Frank Skinner. So, and what an amazing team.
Yeah, it
no one really remembers it. And you were a guest?
Yeah, I was a guest poet.
Yes.
Amongst the comedians. And I read a poem and I was given a cowboy kind of themed costume.
Oh, yeah.
By the designer.
Yeah.
Oh, you look lovely in this. And then he gave me this cowboy thing.
Was it appropriate to the poem? Or was it
was, no, it was no. not. It was great, though. But I had pretty much no idea, actually, about... you don't think about the clothing, you know. Your clothing can talk, can't it? It can talk.
It can.
And that did.
Talk
more than I did.
But you were a big part. When you were part of that big Manchester.
Well, there was a Manchester
scene.
Set. Yeah, the Steve Coogan, John Thompson, Carolina Hearn.
Yeah.
Bob Dillinger.
Yes.
Do you remember Bob Dillinger, guitar playing, funny man with the sort of like Bob Dylan like hair,
yes.
Sort of big hair and stuff. Very dry comedian. Yeah, and the poets and the comedians were all together. Then, you know, and the Fire Eaters and the left-wing lesbian guitar-playing guitar players. They were there. They were there. It was a thing. It still is. and we all played together.
Yeah.
We all did gigs together.
We were all together, Richard.
Yeah, well, it was that burgeoning. I mean, it was the alternative comedy moving into the sort of 80s, moving into the 90s, right? That's so you were sort of there amongst those.
There's
crazy
always a poet acts. Hanging on, basically.
Yeah,
saying, "Can I have a go?"
There are.
What we did, we brought it down.
Yes.
You know, the comedians would bring it up, and then I'd be like, "I'm going to come on and read my poem about racism in Wigan." Because, you know, I clearly didn't know the market.
people would have liked that. I remember various that I was thinking of Sisters from Another Planet, who were an act that auditioned for the new act of the year, Hackney Emperor new act of the year, the same year me and Stuart. Stuart won the competition. Yes. I was knocked out in the first round. It's how that happened. There was an act called We Are Sisters from Another Planet. And they went, "We are sisters from another planet. Sexism, racism, we can't stand it. We can't stand it." And there was one of them was black and one of them was white. So it was like, if they'd both been white, I think that would have, and not women, that would have been a terrible act. But it stuck with me, those ladies. I don't know what they're doing now, the sisters from another planet.
It's good. It shows how a rhyme can stick in the mind.
It does, yeah. It's still there. It's good. Well, that's, you know, this is your skill. This is your skill. And your...
Do you know what I thought of when you said it's still there?
Yeah.
I thought of the toilet. I said a rhyme sticks in the mind.
Right.
And you said, yeah, it's still there.
Yeah.
And I thought it's very similar.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have to admit to it being there, Richard. You know, the image came to my mind.
That's okay.
And I had no... I was speaking to an artist today, earlier on, and he spoke of the imagination as a place that doesn't work with logic. He said images will just attach themselves, you know, without you having any choice about it.
Yes.
And you say them and they make sense, and that's comedy and that's poetry.
It is.
And that's art.
It is, but with comedy, it's got to be funny. With poetry, you can get away with any old shit. Because if you don't understand the poetry, you go, it's probably too clever for me to get.
Yeah.
But if the joke doesn't work, you're fucked. So it's good. But you do both.
It's true. No,
you do comedy and
right.
You do comedy and serious.
You're
stuff.
Absolutely right.
But
we poets have been getting away for years of being slightly funny, you know, and then deadly serious, and saying that that's a thing. But the truth is that there came a time as well when people. Somebody came in and said, "Fuck this! Get the poets out of there, and let's get these comedians on." You know, and things sort of changed slightly after that, and the professionalisation of the arts actually in general, not just comedy actually, but in the arts in general.
It did change, and you know, I know there's people of my, you know, me and Stu kind of came right at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, and we saw a little bit of that. But my main memory of comedy in the 90s is men doing stand-up.
Men, yeah, that's
you know, that white men doing stand-up.
Yes, yeah.
Couple of women, then a couple of poets every now and again.
Yes,
but,
yeah, occasionally.
Didn't get any of the extensions. We've got Tim Key now.
There's a genius
stuff.
who does the funny and does the... How does he do the serious? Yeah, he does. You see, funny can do serious.
Yeah.
And funny at the same time. It's quite incredible. Poets do that as well to a degree. I do love it though, you know, because it's all word based and it's all audience based as well.
Yeah.
And all poets love an audience because they want to be read. And even poets who pretend to hate an audience actually want the audience to read them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they want a successful book, but they don't want to walk on stage as if to walk on stage is to belittle the words by speaking them. Really, honestly, there's nothing more egotistical than saying, "I shall not walk on the stage. I shall not ruin the page by speaking the words to an audience." You know, but there's a very real kind of... movements of writers who believe that the stage is just a place that belittles the word, and it's not. It's a place that upholds it.
Yes. Well, you know, but I think you and I both love language and come at it from different ways. I do, you know, I feel a straight... I've never met you before, I don't think, and I feel a real connection with you through your work. Also, we're almost exactly the same age, which is... I mean, I know... one of us looks a lot younger and better than the other. We're not going to ruin it by saying which one. You were born like about 6 weeks before I was. And, you know.
So did you, like, okay, let's talk music.
Right.
Like, Leo Sayer?
Well, Leo Sayer was
No, but this is a very particular window. Yes. You know, the Leo Sayer window. Do you know what I mean?
It's I
a
do
very
remember
particular
Leo.
Leo Sayer, Blondie?
Blondie's
Blondie,
big.
Blondie, I mean Blondie.
But Blondie, you know, gosh. But Debbie Harry, she was like 35 or something when
was
she was...
She?
Yeah, it was like when I found out...
Oh, my
the
God,
other day,
I feel slightly abused.
She was much older than all the other pop stars.
Is that right?
Yeah, so, like, she's about 70 or so now.
Yeah.
So,
I've never done the calculation.
Yeah,
but
she was, you know, she was an extremely...
Daryl Hall and Oates.
Yeah.
Hall and Oates.
Hall and Oates.
We've got done Leo Sayer...
We could just name all those. Should we name pop stars?
No, I was listening to 1980s tracks on the way down here.
Yeah.
I was having a real nostalgia fest.
Yeah.
Thinking, God, our window is very specific.
Yeah.
And I keep going back to Leo Sayer.
Well, at school it was... No, the thing I associate with school is Madness. We had Suggs
on.
Oh,
yeah, Madness. Oh, yeah.
And I was at a wedding. They had this idea for a thing. I tried to talk to Suggs about it. He didn't get it. But I had I was at a wedding and they were playing all... Like, you know, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And they were playing all the stuff that we used to dance to at school discos. So your House of Fun comes on and you are literally transported back to your school disco.
And what's the name of the fat guy? Lippo, Fatty, Fatty.
Bad Manners.
What's the Bad Manners?
Buster Blood Vessel.
When he Buster Blood Vessel, when he... came onto the scene, we were like, what is that?
So, yes, we have, there's the similarities, and we both, like, as you were saying, you emailed me and said we were both did Edinburgh in the sort of mid to late 80s, and we both obviously were interested in words and performing.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's, I first.
Same father.
Same dad, you've got the same dad, potentially. Potentially, you never know. But you know, I was reading. There's a couple of books we'll talk about. We're going to put this out as one of the book podcasts.
I hate the writer podcasts.
Yeah,
I prefer when you do comedians.
I know it's fine.
I mean, I like the writer.
I mean, I can't really do much about that, Len. Today,
I see.
I've already booked you.
No, that's really out of order. I don't hate them, but they dip a little more than when. Am I right or am I right? When I was invited, I was pissed off. You know what I mean?
They could get a bit more serious, as this one will do in a second.
Yes. Sorry.
But there's two books. Let's talk about your most recent book first, because I think because My Name Is Why is an absolutely incredible book. But let's talk a little lighter first.
Yeah.
It is a heavy book. But this is Let the Light Pour In. And what I'm quite interested about this book. Yeah. Well, you can explain what it is, but I sort of in comedic terms. Have done something similar in that I write a blog every single day.
Oh yeah, you do.
So
of course.
So tell us about.
I write a 4-line poem every day that rhymes on the second and the fourth line. It's a quatrain. It's known as a quatrain. And I get up in the morning. It's a good time to get up. that's Kevin Turvey, isn't it? Kevin Turvey. that's Kevin Turvey. So anyway, so I get up in the morning. See, people don't see me like this. You know what I mean, the poet. You know. So I get up in the morning and I write a four-line poem.
Yeah.
Rhymes on the second and the fourth line. And rhymes on the second and the fourth line just to piss off the really literary people. I find a rhyme. I woke up one morning and I thought of this one. Batman... this is a literary one. Batman to the Batcave. Robin, what now? Batman, thwack, Robin, ow. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's the depth.
It is.
It's the depth. But I write them in the morning, on the day, and put them out. And so they're all out there on the interwebs. Thousands of them.
Yeah.
And most of them are crap. But I'm trying. And that's what a writer does, and that's what a comedian does.
Yeah.
You face every day the possibility that you might be crap in front of people.
Yes.
Right? And people don't get that often. They often think that to put something out on the internet is to show off. And it's not. It's to actually make yourself vulnerable to the idea that somebody's going to look at it and think, what the hell does he think? Why did he do that? these are the best ones.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, 250 of the best ones. And there's no title to any one poem, so it'll never be a poem on the underground. There's no... It's true. There's no title, and there's no content list. You can open it and close it, open it any way you want.
Yeah.
And it still became a Sunday Times bestseller.
It's well.
I couldn't have predicted that. You can't know. Sorry, Lem. I'll stop. I know what I'm doing. I'm railroading.
No, you're allowed to railroad. You're allowed to railroad. I think it's interesting.
Me.
This is about you. You're allowed to talk about you.
I can question myself and answer myself over the next hour. It's not right.
I love the way you talked to yourself in the middle of that and said, Lem, come on, Lem. it is similar. I've been writing a blog post every day for 22 years, right? So, wow. And yeah, it's exactly the same thing. That it's just putting something out there. I did it for myself, really, just as a warming up thing. You get better as a writer.
Yes.
Reading this, you kind of go, oh yeah, look, you could, you know, that's what a brilliant thing for anyone to do.
Anyone,
right? To write a four line, you know, there's 20 words in most of them.
Yeah.
Poems got a rhyme, maybe if you don't have to, if you don't want to.
Yeah.
And you write that every day, and yeah, like you do 1,000 and 250 go in a book, and people love it. And you dip into this. And it really, you don't want to read, you know, a lot of them are about the morning and a lot of them about the night meeting the day, and which is a very interesting thematically anyway. But you don't want to sit down. I did sit down and read them all in a row. Don't do that. put it by your bed or by the toilet. And then dip in. But there's, you know, this was my favourite one. If someone is copying you, remember thereupon, anyone can find the switch when the lights are on. There's lots of beautiful imagery in there, and it is just, you know, sometimes you'll find it and sometimes you'll find something that might be an idea later on.
Yes.
I've really found with the writing, you know, trying to be funny about the day. I think back in the day when I was younger and not married and didn't have kids and interesting things happened to me, you know, the hit rate was probably one in about three. But now the hit rate's about once a month funny.
Yes.
Not that much happens to me.
Yes. I get exactly that.
Yeah.
You know, and the action, not repetitive, I don't find it repetitive, but the action, I don't know, it's like some people in the morning, they will have water and lemon and it sort of wakes up the constitution, you know. It's a little bit like that. It kind of tunes you into as kind of the place in your head where you're creative or where you're... I'm dying here. I am just dying. But it's it's a good action. It's like going for a run for your body, really.
Yeah.
You know.
So, but you know, so it is. I mean, the idea with my blog was to turn my brain on and get me ready to write for the day.
That's a great
idea. Of the time, I write and go, "Oh, I've done enough now."
Yeah. But you've got
a book out of it.
But you do it for you.
Yeah.
This is important. This is an important thing. You don't do it for the audience. You're doing it for you. And I think that the audience quite often, not as a singular person, but as a group. Can assume that you're doing it for them. And actually, we have to do what we do because we do what we do.
Yeah.
It sounds quite egotistical. It's the opposite. We're not dancing monkeys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We do it well. I mean, it depends on the feet, you know. Do you know what I mean? I will dance like a freaking monkey if I'm paid enough money. Okay. But that's another story. But the point is integrity is really important in literature. And I find that if you look, you will find a way to do monkey dancing from a place of integrity, yeah. Richard.
Okay. If it pays you enough money to do the other stuff, then it's okay. It's a balance. So there is an integrity.
I believe that I could have integrity by not doing anything with integrity.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I could find a reason to do nothing with integrity. Richard with integrity.
Okay, that's good. As long as you can make that in your head and make that distinction and make it work
always,
for you.
Always, that's, Richard. That's all, that's always.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a beautiful book. Let the Light Pour In. It's, you know, it's a... I think it is. I think it's just, it's that thing that you think, you read it and you think, oh, I could have a go. I mean, I won't be as good. I won't be as imaginative.
You can be. You would be.
But, I'd be happy to have a go at that. I think it's just a nice thing to do. And, you know, I think as a writer, I've found that it's so hard to sit down and write, right? And a lot of the, and I'm just through a period where I've been doing this a lot. I've been doing a lot of podcasts.
Yes.
And it's quite, you know, and I've actually in the last year and a half, I've sort of said, I'm not, you know, I'm writing my blog and occasional bits and pieces, but I'm not really writing anything else, which is it's the first time for ages that I've done that, that I haven't been working on something else. But it is, it then becomes hard to get back into it if you're not careful. Right. And so just by doing something that makes, that applies you, makes you start thinking, I think is terrific as well. So
you can know, I've got to say, I'm really sorry about that whole integrity joke. It didn't work, and it's going to sound like I've not got integrity as well now, but I've got to live with that. But the thing is, it's not always good, and it's not always easy either to do it as well. And sometimes you have to give yourself a push, and also sometimes you don't reach the place that you'd like to have reached, and you know, all of that stuff that the writer has and the creative has.
Yeah.
You know, you're in it.
Yeah.
We're in it every day. But the book came out. It wasn't meant to be a book. It just happened. And same with your blog, when that becomes a book and becomes a source, actually source material for all kinds of things, shows and what have you. And more people should do this.
Yeah.
It's open to everybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It is. I mean, you don't have to put it on the internet, but if I'm putting on, you know, it's exactly that. I don't even think of any. Occasionally, someone will email me and say, "That's a great blog," or "I was interested in that blog," and I'd forgotten that people read it. You know, and it, you don't have to put it online, but I think by putting it online, it sort of encourages you to carry. You know, it's got to be there. It's got to be somewhere. Whereas I think if you just do it for yourself, you might think, "Oh, I don't need to do it today," because you know, no one knows about it. So I think it can help encourage you. But it's a fantastic writing exercise if anyone's interested in writing for themselves.
Or creative exercise. Yeah. If you're a painter, you know, or a draw, you know, if you'd like to draw, and you don't have to, you know, there's something punk rock about not asking a publisher.
Yeah.
You know, if this is okay. You know, and then you get writers like Len Penny from Scotland who just go straight to Instagram, you know, and Rupi Kaur in India who's selling all of love poetry all over the world and has not asked a publisher.
Yeah.
You know, the canon is being challenged in a very big way.
Yes.
It's an exciting time for creativity, you know. I'm really looking, because when I get bored, I just go turn to AI. And just get that to do the morning. Do you know what I mean? And that's, most of them in there have been done. I was talking about integrity before, wasn't I? You know.
Yeah.
I believe that I am embracing AI emotionally by allowing it to write my morning poems and put them out. I mean, people have been dying of cancer and used my poems. In all seriousness, there's a man who's got them tattooed on his arm. You can Google it and see it. And I say dying of cancer, I mean living, actually, with cancer and using my poems. But they don't know that it is an AI poem that wrote it. Do you know what I mean? But now, because I'm on your show, Richard, I want to share that.
It's good to know.
I want to share that with
I've tried. I think, you know, nothing... An AI could not replicate what goes on in your brain, is what I'm going to say for sure. I tried, as a test, I did a few blogs that I would wrote around that I tried to do AI with the blog, and they were not good.
Yes.
So at the moment, it's not there. I don't think AI is there yet. I don't think AI will ever get into the brain of Lemsay. That is my guess. So I mean,
you could get an AI, for example, in all seriousness, to describe as this vase of water that's in front of us, and then. Ascribe that, is that the right word, to it being a metaphor for something.
Yes.
And then you could read everything into the plain description as metaphor for whatever. You know, we're not a long way off AI being able to...
Oh, I agree with that, because the weirder bits of AI are you know, I think what when you see a good writer, what's great about this book is it's a lot of the same themes, a lot of the same places, and you'll find a new way of describing something. There was something about I can't remember the wind doing something with the water. I can't remember what it was. Can you remember that one?
But
the way the wind, I think the wind washing the water.
Yes, yeah, right?
That's such a beautiful image. Yeah. That, you know, I think, again, AI might come up with that accidentally, but a human being can come up with it on purpose. But, yeah, it is when it's sort of with comedy and with poetry, it's about coming at something from a different angle that is familiar and that people will understand, hopefully, but that is unique to you as well. So, that's the beauty of creativity.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Let's talk a little bit about. I know you've talked about this book a lot, and I know you've talked about your story a lot.
It's never two things. Something I want to say to you: it's never old.
No.
And when I leave here, it's still there.
Yes.
So, yesterday was Mother's Day. The day before that was International Women's Week, etc. But the thing is, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I've done enough therapy.
Yes.
I've forgiven. That was my biggest thing. I mean, nobody knows what the story is.
It's an extraordinary, it's an extraordinary story. And I think the reason is that the book's called My Name Is Why, and it's about your childhood. And it's extremely moving. It's a very upsetting book in a lot of ways. But I think also the way you've come through an experience that I think. I actually can't think of much worse than the experience you've been through, and it's not about physical abuse. Right. You would think it would be, but it's sort of worse than that. But because of what you've done with your life, it's so amazing. But I think for starters, right, thinking of you and me being almost the same age. That thing my daughter was saying about the idea of babies being lined up in some room waiting to be born.
Yes,
you know, you and I. You and I would be, if there was that room, you and all babies look the same and then they're born.
Yeah, yeah.
You and I would have been in that room at the same time. Yeah. And, you know, that you have no control over where a sperm meets an egg and where you appear in the world and who you appear in the world from.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, it made me realise how incredibly lucky I'd been to be born into a family that wanted me and loved me and could have me. And I know your mum... Your birth mum did want you and wasn't able to keep you. But then, I mean, you know, well, look, I guess that's why, partly why it affected me so much, but it would affect anyone. I think we're probably very similar kids. We're both kind of cheeky and wanted the centre of attention.
Yeah, yeah.
You seem like a lovely, lovely young boy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and creative and funny. And,
yeah, 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 yeah.
So it really, you know, it really...
No, really... it's so nice because I was that kid that people would be like, you know, you were probably that as well. But people were like, what is going on with that? You know, because people smiled. I thought that the whole world smiled. I've said, but why? Well, I'll say it again. But I thought the world smiled, and I didn't realize that it was me smiling at the world and the world smiling back at me.
Yeah.
I thought the world smiled. People, everybody smiles. It was beautiful, a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And somebody said to me that my light shone too brightly, and there were other factors going on in the family which had nothing to do with me, and I was going to be the fall guy.
Yeah.
For the family, and I was, you know, and at 12 years of age, the people who said that they were my mum and dad forever put me into care and said they'd never visit me, and I lost everybody, my brothers, my sisters, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, my grandparents, my granddad and my grandma, you know, so when I say that it's a live story, you know, and thank whatever that I got to be able to truly forgive the family that did it. Because it was about the breaking down of a human spirit. And I remember when I left care at 18, left the children's homes at 18, I remember people would talk about abuse being one thing. What, it wasn't nuanced at all. It was one thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I have been abused, but that didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
So I had to wait for the country and the dialogue and understanding of what a kid's... I had to wait for that to... happen, for people to understand my story. When I started writing poetry and gigging with Steve and with Henry and with John Thompson and Caroline Hearn, and for that short window before they all, you know, became the brilliance that they were. Actually, they were all brilliant then, actually, very clearly. But I knew then, right? I didn't tell anybody, but I knew then that the moment I would get some attention, I would bring that attention to the story of my family. And I would ask people, look what happened to me.
Yeah.
And I would wait for document. So I had one gig. My one gig was write poetry, get audience, use what you've done, because they took my smile away. They took my smile away.
Yeah. I mean,
I actually lost my ability to smile fully. And they took that, So I had to. So there are a series of documentaries that have been made in my adult life, where you can see me taking people back. So the penny starts to drop. A series of documentaries. The moment I got known as a poet and writer, my job was then to bring people to the attention of my childhood. I didn't fucking want to. I've got shit to do. Yeah. I love writing. I love performing, right? But from the 18 years of age, I went to Manchester and I wanted to perform and I wanted to write, and I did. But I knew that every time I got a little bit of recognition, I had nobody. I had no mother, father, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, granddad, nobody who'd known me since my childhood. Mm. So I was aware that the more I became known, the less I had. Richard, the less I had, because I was fully aware, I was like, to be recognised is to be seen for having nothing. I would turn around and the only people I would know are people who'd known me for 2 years. And they were off, you know, they were off on their careers, like, way. And I used to look at people with their families, their dysfunctional families, you know, the messiness and the ugliness of families. And I didn't have that echo. And I couldn't get away from the fact I didn't have it on birthdays, at Christmases, at Easters, at weekends, when friends went home to their family because they'd hurt themselves, or, you know, they'd deny the parents. People would be like, I bloody hate my mum and dad. They're a pain in the backside. They kept me back all my life. And then they'd be back to get the washing done. Do you know what I mean? Because they feel like it's their right.
Yeah.
You know, and it is their right.
It is their right.
Bloody hell, you don't want your kid to know how important family is. Because you don't want them to lose family to realise. You want them to just take it for granted, please.
Yeah. Look, it is so
effective. Writing the book was my way.
Well, no, but you've done so much with this. It's an amazing story, and it is, you know, this is a... It's just the worst possible betrayal. I mean, I know the family that fostered you you saw them as your family.
The deal was that my mother didn't want me, and they were my mum and dad forever.
Yeah.
That was the deal,
yeah.
Okay? And they taught me to say mum and dad to them. That was the deal. And then when I was 12, on the edge of adolescence, they were like, "Oh no, you're gonna, what are you?" And I was like, "I was the criminal in the family." And the problem is that it's very easy for anybody else to believe, because there's a prejudice against children in care. It's as if they must have done something wrong. You know,
yeah.
What? When I went into care, I was like, "What did you do wrong?" I was
yes.
Like, wow. I did. Yes. Yes, I burned the house down. Yes. Yes. But, you know, I was a broken child. And that was my right.
The truth is, you know, that you don't... As a parent, you know, now being a parent and having kids nearly that age, the idea... Oh, you know, just thinking to myself, my mum and dad had turned around to be 12 saying, sorry, you don't really love us, do you?
Yeah.
So, you know, you were manipulated by them. Yeah. You were a nice kid and manipulated by them. And that, you know, you can't make an excuse. You know, there's always a part of your brain going, well, what can we, you know, maybe they had, maybe they weren't expecting to have three kids of their own, but you still can't then go, oh, I've had four kids and I'm, you know, so I'm going to let one of them go. That's not the contract as a parent, is it?
So let me just say this then. Let me say that some parents in some families do things that they may not be proud of, or maybe they have their own dysfunctions that they may not share with the rest of the family, and you never know who's going to out you. You never know, like, what child, what moment is going to just upend you, and what I'm trying to say is that it's very easy to demonize them.
Yeah. It is very easy.
Yeah. I'm aware that the story. I'm aware that there are more victims in that story than me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But look, you're a remarkable man.
I am.
And you are.
Thank you.
It's remarkable.
I was working by the whole thing was for that.
I mean, I think this would, you know...
There's somebody out there who's going, you know, I don't like it. You know, I like my victims to be victims.
Yeah.
I don't want this flipping, you know...
I think, like, to be able to have that much forgiveness in your heart is a beautiful thing.
And no, I would die without it.
Well,
if I didn't forgive, I would become the bitter, angry... I mean, the greatest thing about forgiveness... And, by the way, one of the privileges of having family is that you don't have to forgive. You can carry that gripe forever. You can get married on it. You can build a house on it. Go to university on it. Why the hell would you forgive? Just keep doing it. It's one of the privileges of having a family is that you don't have to forgive. And if you think that your parent, just before they die, is going to go, I'm sorry. It's not going to happen. Okay? It's not going to happen. Remember this. One of the privileges of having a family is that you don't have to forgive. And you can get married on that. And actually, that's true. It's true. You can look at your own child crying, weeping, looking at you, saying, "Dad," and you can look at them and think, "You're going to be in therapy over this. You're going to be in therapy over this, and it's not my fault." But you know, I do forgive them. I took it back the next day.
Yeah,
I woke up the next morning. I thought, "No, bastards." Do you know what I mean? Because forgiveness is not an easy, you know, you don't have to keep it up.
But you don't. And but also, you know, that you've found your way through this extraordinary, you know, I can't, you know, both ways. I'm looking at my kids, and I'm looking at my parents, and either way, you know, it just, it breaks my heart, you know, and it's just horrific. But you've, you know, you were in care for, in the back in the care system, which was for most of your teenage years.
Yeah.
And, well, all your teenage years. And yet you have pushed through that, and a lot of people fall by the wayside in that, and not their fault, but, yes. You know, and you've got survived that, and are now an OBE. You've been given an MBE by the Queen and an OBE by the King.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're the Vice Chancellor of Manchester University. You were. And,
Check me out.
It's incredible. So, you know, it's an absolutely incredible story.
So you missed a few things.
Yeah, there's... You won the Pinter Award, the Pinter Penn Pinter Award.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. And look at the people who won that's pretty good.
There's some other things.
But yeah. You're, you know, but you're that spirit that you had that they did, you know...
I'm a doctor.
Would have been
your doctor. Seven times.
Okay, I've not...
But you didn't say that, though.
I didn't say that.
I'm thinking about my childhood. Why would you not say? Is that because you went to Oxford?
I went to Oxford University.
It's because you went to Oxford.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I don't carry these things with me.
You're honorary fellow of
I'm
Cambridge.
I'm an honorary
and
fellow
and
of Jesus College in Cambridge. Of Jesus.
Yeah.
An honorary fellow of Jesus. And Mansfield College in your Oxford.
In Oxford, yes. I don't know if that should be allowed. I haven't got anything. I work my balls off, literally, in one case. I didn't do anything. I don't deserve a thing. Look, there's a few things from this story that intersect with the comedy world that I just want to talk to you about as well. And I think this is the story about... I mean, I'm going to be speaking later, quite in a couple of weeks... to Tommy Cannon. No, actually in a couple of weeks.
Oh,
to Tommy Cannon from Cannon and Ball.
Oh, wow.
In Hull. And so you had this amazing... And I think this, again, sort of shows why some... You know, what this job that we're both doing in our own way can do, that you had this day out to go and see Cannon and Ball, and Lenny Henry was...
Yes,
Was one of the other guys on the in the show... and you seeing Lenny Henry, you know, obviously up there, and I mean, it was before
he's
he was super
surfing.
Famous.
He's crowd surfing, right? And he says he's pointing out to the audience to bring somebody on stage. And I've spoken to him about this.
Have you? Yeah.
And it's in his book as well that he did this gig with Cannon and Ball in Blackpool. So they get all the taxis in Manchester, and they bring all the kids in care from all the different children's homes, and they take them to the pantomime. And yes, this is how the arts. Actually, some magic happens.
Yeah.
And he's crowd surfing. I'm the only black kid there, and it's Lancashire, and it's you know, we're from a pit town. I'm from a pit town. You know, we used to... People would go nicking coal. It's how it was. And it's Kez. You know Kez?
Yeah.
You know Kez. It's Kez. It's Kez territory.
Yeah.
It's Kez territory. And, he's like looking for somebody in the audience, and I can't remember what I said. But all the kids in the children's home who were sat around me are like, "Hey!" to me.
Yeah.
And he gets me on stage, and that's the first time that I'd been on stage.
Yeah.
And I freaking loved it. And so when I'm writing the book, I'm thinking, because I don't have family, family relates to memory because you were in a place at a time and you'll say to your daughter, do you remember when we went on holiday to wherever? Yeah. And she'll say, no, we didn't. And you'll say, yeah, we did. And she'll say, no, we didn't. And the argument is what makes the memory.
Yes.
You know, this is why a family is a set of disputed memories between one group of people over a lifetime. Well, And I realised that I didn't have anybody to dispute the memory of me.
Yes, yes.
And so that has always... So I've, this is why documentary is important. So I go on Wikipedia to look to see if there was a concert with Lenny Henry in Blackpool in the mid to early 80s.
Yeah.
And it's there. It's there, clear as day. And so I was like, yeah. And then in the book, I write... Family's a set of disputed memories. I had to look in Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it's there. And then I read in Lenny Henry's latest book of his childhood, of his career, and he talks about going on that actual concert.
Right.
And then I choose to interview Lenny Henry at the Bradford Book Fair.
Yes.
And we sit on stage and talk about that moment. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And he did a picture of himself reading that book. Now, you know how memories can be kind of skewed? I'm pretty sure it was me and I did go on stage. But there was a look in his eye, which has always made me think, did he crowd surf? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Did he get me on stage, or was he crowd surfing specifically? Because he would know if that's something he did. You
yes,
know,
of course,
that,
yeah.
That tour. But he did, and he said he did, and which was kind. It's a bit like if you're a teacher and somebody comes back to you years later, they say, "Sir, you were the greatest teacher," and the teacher's looking at you thinking, "Who are you?" you don't realise that, but you know, so. So it
doesn't matter if he
thing.
Did or he didn't, though. If you,
no,
you
it
know,
so no,
you
know. He was there. It yeah, was
but it doesn't
we
matter.
We did come to it, but whether I went on stage
yeah,
or not,
but that whole thing. But that's how magical it. Well, you know, if it didn't happen, it's sort of that's the magic of the.
So important. I've got to say, to see a person of colour on stage was also really exciting yes. because I didn't meet people who looked like me. I was scared shitless of black people. And that's when I knew that so were the people who were around me who would go to the city of Manchester and become social workers. I was like, oh, no, I grew up with you. I know what your experience was. You were frightened. And you need to actually address that as you walk through your professional careers. But anyway, that's a whole other insight. But to see a person of colour on stage was just magnificent for me, you know. It's like... I could somehow identify that I was somehow connected to that person, and that meant a lot because the colour of my skin was the subject of the day in Wigan and Atherton. Yeah. You know, it was like my nickname was Chalky White.
Yeah, well, I was going to say this,
and I loved every minute of it because it was the only way I could curry favour in the sort of confused racial understandings of a pit town in the northwest of England in the mid-80s.
Yeah. Well, some people might not remember that was a... I mean, some might say racist character created by the otherwise exemplary comedian Jim Davidson.
Otherwise, he was great.
Otherwise,
that's the problem. Him and Bernard Manning. You know, Bernard Manning was a great comedian... He was just a little bit flawed on his politics, you see. If you watch the lilt of his lines...
But, you know, it's sort of... I mean, that's sort of so fascinating to me because it actually became a sort of badge of honour as a kid, but then obviously something that you then had to reject.
Oh.
Of course.
Look, I knew on some level, you know... I knew on some level, deep inside me, that it was utterly flawed. You know, I was intelligent enough to know that, okay, my experience now at 12 years of age, it was 12 when I was christened the nickname Chalky White, my experience now is to go with this and to milk it for every bit it's got, but don't trust it.
Yeah.
And so immediately you're on enemy lines, making the enemy like you, but knowing that the enemy could turn at any minute and beat the shit out of you.
Yeah.
And that was my childhood. That was like Atherton and Lee and Wigan. I'm sorry, folks, but it was. But were they kind, good, well-meaning people in those towns? Yes, 100%. And in fact, quite a lot of them had a voice at the back of their minds going, we shouldn't be calling him Chalky.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's The nature of human beings is really complex, isn't it? And the thing about forgiveness and empathy and knowledge is these situations allow us to employ those things, you know.
Yeah, and you know the book is you've got all this source material because someone found all of the you know all the notes about you,
my
all
files.
The
I've been
files
looking
about
for my
you.
Files.
And I think what's interesting about that
in
is...
In lieu of family, I've got to say, in lieu of family,
yeah.
The files were memories of me.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But also interesting because, you know, it shows up there was awful people looking after you and there was some good people. And I mean, the social worker who drove you to the first home.
A good man. He's a friend.
Yeah. I mean, but also he knew what was happening was...
He couldn't do anything.
He couldn't do anything about it. He knew what he was doing was awful. You were blaming yourself and he was saying, you mustn't blame yourself.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, you were... But of course you were going to blame yourself.
Yeah. And his hands were tied.
Yeah.
And I have nobody else to blame. This must have been down to me in some way, shape or form. And that is, you know, that's a natural way that a child does think on emotionally. Is like, oh, it must be me. And so I spent a lot of my adult life trying to prove that it wasn't. It actually wasn't. To find the proof, I took the government to court when I got the files. You know, I was like, there's the proof, man. Took them to court, settled out of court for some money. And thank you. Settled out of court and then immediately got the book.
Yeah.
Immediately wrote the book and immediately used the files as the...
Well, and it proves, you know, it proves that your birth mum wanted to...
Yeah, all of that.
Wanted you to come to over and they didn't... they sort of said, oh, he's in a nice family, so I don't think we should do anything about it.
It was all a plan. Steve Coogan, years later, this is how worlds come together, actually, did the film Philomena.
Yeah.
And that was really important to educate people culturally, like in the country. This is where the arts is incredible.
Yes.
About the mother and baby homes that were all throughout England, not just for Irish women, for English women as well, etc. And my mum just landed in this country pregnant at the wrong time. She was put into a mother and baby home, and the primary purpose was to get the child adopted. My mum refused to have me adopted. She came here to study. She had no intention of staying here. But Ethiopia, you know, she's from Ethiopia. Ethiopia's, you know, not been colonised, not like England in 1066. Right? Ethiopia's not, you know, that's not Ethiopia's experience. She came here to study and then to go back. Under the Emperor Haile Selassie's expansion at the time. But God, she landed into a nightmare when she went into that mother and baby home. And through doing gigs, I met the woman who was in the bed next to her.
Right.
Through doing gigs, that woman went searching for her own son. And she was an actor in Coronation Street as well.
Wow.
So, you know, the arts and art is so central to raising awareness and helping us as a culture live with our pasts and live in our presence, you know. So I took the government to court, published the book, and also I spent my adult life searching for my family.
Yeah.
So putting this... So anything that I got from poetry and from live gigs, which I've done all my adult life, I used to find my family, and I found them all over the world. My mum, my dad, my dad was a pilot for Ethiopian Airlines. My mum worked for the United Nations. My brothers and sisters are all over the world since the revolution in 74, etc. And I followed through Ethiopia. And I've gone back to Ethiopia. And I'm known there. You know what? I'm known as the poet whose name is Y, who found his family, who came back to Ethiopia. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Like and is still the boy from Wigan. And I'm known to my people, so I travel anywhere in the world. I'll see Ethiopians, and they'll be like, Lemon. Because my name is said Lemon in Ethiopia. For the first bit of my life, I thought my name was Norman.
Yes.
Okay, that's what they call me, because I look like Norman, don't I? I'm a gold Norman. I thought my name was Norman for like 16 years. Norman? Norman. People will stop me.
All right, Norman.
Norman. There's nothing wrong with Norman. And I only found out about 3 years ago that Norman means man of the north. Isn't that fantastic? Man of the freaking north. At 21 years of age, interviewed by Tony Wilson. Half an hour on Granada TV, and I'd only been Lem Cisse for 3 years, you know. And people say, now I'm interviewing myself. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry. It's just that I didn't change. I just remained exactly the same. I became more of myself.
Yeah.
People say, oh, you know, oh, you've gone from Norman to Lem Cissé. I was like, no, I was always Lem Cissé. I just didn't know, you know, and I'm the same person.
Of course. And, you know, of course you should go back to... I mean, the Norman came from the original guy. You know,
that was, that was the man who stole me from my mother, essentially.
So he named you after himself.
Yeah, he named me after himself. Yeah, the social worker.
While taking your life away from you. I mean, it's you know, the whole thing, you know, if someone came to you and said, this is written by Charles Dickens and this happened in the 19th century, I would go, yep. If someone says this happened in the 1980s to 1970s, 1980s, you'd go, what the fuck? You know, it's absolutely unbelievable. So it is so important that you've drawn attention to it. It is very important that you've sued.
I didn't want to, though. But, you know, I wanted to live a life.
Yeah, of course.
I wanted to be a poet and a writer, and I wanted to think of the lines and my sentences and my blah, and I didn't have the opportunity to be as good as what I think I could be. And that's just the way that is. But doing this book, the Let the Light Pour In, it's my way of just kicking away from that. And just kicking away from other people saying whether you're this or that. And just,
But, you know, as you must, but I think it's sort of, it is so, I think it's very important for you and for the world that needs to know to tell that story. Now you've told the story and you've lived the story and it's, you know, it's, you know, and now you can go on to other things, which, you know.
Yeah.
And which we're doing anyway.
Thank you. You see me.
Yeah.
You see me. And there's one poem in here, which I said before is tattooed on a guy's arm.
Yeah.
And I want to say it's, can I read it?
Yeah.
Because it says everything about the story. How do you do it, said night? How do you wake and shine? I keep it simple, said light, one day at a time. And that's basically how I try to live my life.
Yeah.
I don't live it like that all the time, but I try to. So he's tattooed it on his arm, and I need to tell you, Richard, that I'm suing him.
Copyright?
Absolutely. They think I'm laughing. I'm joking. I'm not joking. Two reasons, right? Firstly, he's not put my name.
Okay.
All right, he's not put my name on it. And secondly, I'm calculating how many times it gets read. It's a legal precedence, it's called, I think, that legally it's going to set a precedence.
I mean, because if you don't do that, people could just start, you know,
they're doing it already.
Tattoo your poems everywhere.
No, there are people. I've got people who've got like. Well, somebody's got the Mancunian Way, which is a tattoo of mine. Somebody's got invisible kisses on their back. Somebody else has got something else somewhere else. A woman came to me at a gig, signing books, and she said, "Oh, I've got a tattoo of your poem." And I said, "Have you? Can I see it?" She just maintained eye contact. It was just a big no. And I realised I felt like I'd stepped into something.
But also your poetry is it's all over Manchester, it's all over the world.
It's on,
you know,
in public spaces.
That's so wonderful.
Yeah.
And like, so those things
myself into the walls and streets of Manchester and Addis Ababa, and there's a few here in London, Royal Festival Hall, and in the city there's a poem on the side of a architecture, a sculptor and stuff.
Yeah.
I've done as best as I can with what I've got, right? And that's what we do, right?
Yeah.
You've done that. You've done that throughout your career. And I think all of the artists, whether it's Steve Coogan or Henry Normal, they've all done the best they can with what they've got. And that is their familial side, their own families, you know. That has become part of all of their narratives. And it's part of mine as well, which is why I've had to go the direction that I've gone in. It's a funny old world, isn't it? Who knew that comedians talking would be a thing? Do you know what I mean? Who knew that? Because when you started your career, you're like, oh, I'll do stand-up, oh, I'll do a show, oh, I'll do a bit of TV. And then if you do really well, you get Parkinson. You know what I mean? You get to talk to an old man in a thing who goes, hey, Sonny Jim, I've seen you doing pretty well these days. And you'd have a jovial chat. Whereas, who knew that it would just be like, oh, no, just sit and chat.
I know, it's nuts.
It's quite incredible how this industry and how creativity will always find a way. Always find a way.
Yeah. Well, you know, you know, we are so different in lots of ways, you and I, but, you know, I don't know.
You're black, I'm white.
Exactly. I can't see colour, so I don't. You may be right about it. I don't know.
I grew up with people saying, I don't see colour. And I'd be like, why do you only not see colour when you see me?
But, you know, it's just... But I think we can... No, I've always seen this with comedians, when comedians... You don't even need to know each other. Most comedians will just, you know... They don't always get on, but they recognise each other, they like each other. And I just recognised in you. And I think it is those coincidences of, you know, our age being so similar. And I think, you know, I think there's something in essence very similar to us. And you know, and I feel... that's why I feel this is just heartbreaking, because I can absolutely, you know, not that you need to empathise to find this heartbreaking, but it just feels so, you know, I can see a different path where, you know, just luck goes one way or the other, and chance happens one way or the other, and it's just, it's. I don't think I would have got through that in the same way that you've got through it.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't have got through it in the same way.
If you sat, you'd have been white. You know?
I mean, I'm joking.
But no, because that is a big part of it as well.
No, people get through in different ways. Yeah. You know, I've got, you know, my friend back in Atherton, his name's Peter Libby. He replaces windows and he's good at it and he's respected by his community and he's got 2-3 kids and he's got a semi-detached or a detached beautiful house and a beautiful wife and he holds together his life. That's success.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think what you're doing with poetry is so important. I think what you're talking, you know, I studied English for A-level, sort of at almost, I kind of came to it a bit. I was going to do physics and then I changed to English. And it wasn't, you know, I found poetry very intimidating. And
yeah.
I mean, I was studying Lamia by John Keats, which is not the easiest poem to understand.
No.
That's,
I have no idea.
No.
What labia?
Yeah, labia. I think it was called labia. Is it called labia?
I know what labia is. I just didn't know yeats.
But this, you know, what you're doing is smart. Some of it I don't understand. Some of it I need to look up the words. Yeah. Some of it I don't. Some of it I don't. You know, I want to go back and look at it again because I don't get it, which you shouldn't do. Some of it's funny. Some of it's a riddle. Some of it's very wise. Some of it's impenetrable to, you know, I know that I've got to find a way through. But it is something, you know, I think what you were doing right from the beginning with your poetry was saying, this is for us.
Yes.
You know, this isn't this thing for universities and bookshelves. And this is a thing, a living thing for everyone to enjoy.
Yes, but I don't want to be, actually, I am really into things that we don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, I really find it, that kind of exciting, and I don't want to be anti-academic or either anti... I think there's a lot of beautiful poetry out there that I don't understand, and I think not understanding is part of the excitement of life, because, you know, you can try to. You know?
Yeah.
It's really, you know, it's like jazz. What the hell's that about?
Shabba-da-wa.
You know? And then I think, but if you think to yourself, I'm walking down a street in Manhattan... Then you can listen to it and think, oh, yeah, I get this. It's just, it's a beautiful thing, actually. And classical music, I love classical music.
Well, look, it's your spirit, which I, you know, I think has survived all of this and is still shining through. And when you smile, it still makes everyone smile. It's fantastic. So I hope everyone will... definitely buy the new book because it's joyous. Definitely buy My Name Is Why because it's very, you know, you're going to go through an emotional rollercoaster, but I think it's a very important book. And it's still like a beautifully written and fantastic book. And you know, I think the triumph of it is you sitting here and being a bit crazy, but not as crazy as you should be.
Not as crazy as what happened to me. And also, I love the stage and I love the comms of it, the clarity of it as well. I think I'm
I think I'm pretty sane in comparison with the people who worked in the institutions that did what they did to me.
You definitely
are. And they were always telling me what sanity was, you know.
Yeah.
They were always telling me, oh, no, that's crazy. Oh, that's crazy. Doing, acting like that, that's crazy. Now, this is normal. Do you know what I mean? And actually, you know, this is the thing about the poets and the artists and the comedians and the painters and the people who we think of as abstract. We don't think of, you know, cleaning the car on a Sunday as abstract and going, yeah, Tony, look at his, you see your bloody face in that. Look at that. We don't think of that as abstract. We don't think of hospital corners on beds. Look at that. Absolutely sweet. We don't think of that as abnormal. Shut up. Do you know what I mean? I'm doing faces.
It's good.
I know it's not interpreting, is it?
It's all right.
I could be really good. I could be good, man. Do you know what I mean? If I could package me,
yeah,
I'd be the dog's bollocks. I swear to God, I could tour me.
Yeah.
If I could do like me, a little bit of race, a little bit of sad story.
Yeah.
One microphone, a little bit of trauma, and close it at the end with a moment of unity. I've got a show, man.
Yeah,
I've got a show. I'm thinking Sky Arts. You know what I mean? I'm thinking Sky Arts. I'm thinking that if I don't package it, Richard, package it. It's not legitimate.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Legitimacy comes through the package, Richard.
Yeah, exactly. Very important.
It's same with authenticity. You know, we need to know the beginning, the middle, the end. We need to go on a journey, Richard.
Yeah, we do.
We need to go on a journey, Richard. We need to go on a journey. We need to go on a journey. We need to wind down the windows and feel the air of authenticity. Rush across our stony faces, Richard.
Yeah, good. It's beautiful. We do need to go on a journey. We need to go on a journey over there. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give up the amazing Lem Cissé. I've been listening to Rahulastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Lem Cissé. Thank you to Scant Regard, playing the music, not live this time. I'm indebted to Ben Walker, and of course, Chris Evans, not that one, Ben Evans, not that one. And thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, especially Jess Davies. And thank you to George and all of the team. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz on GoFosterStripe.com production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.